feminist men.
We're really at the beginning of this new era, and I think that whether or not one uses the word pro-feminist or anti-sexist or just, I just want to do the right thing, I'm not as interested in the terminology as I am in advancing this transformation of men and masculinity.
That's Rob Okun. He's edited a collection of articles from the pro-feminist men's journal, Voicemail. That's M-A-L-E. It's called Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Then we re-air our 2009 interview with feminist poet Robin Moore about the anthology she edited, Poems from the Women's Movement. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We celebrated International Women's Day on March 8th. First celebrated in 1910, it became generally adopted as a holiday in the U.S. in the 1980s. Improvements in opportunities for women have been great since the modern feminist movement began in 1970. Yet women still earn about 77% of the pay men do in similar jobs. They're still 85% of the victims of domestic violence, with about a quarter of all U.S. women assaulted at some point in their lives. My guest, Rob Okun, says that men need to step up to the plate to fight for women's equal rights and an end to domestic violence. What's at stake is not only ending injustice against women, but also promoting the freedom for men to become more fully themselves as human beings. Society's notions of masculinity rob men of connection to their inner selves and to others, Okun says. Men can only be free if women are. That's the premise of the pro-feminist men's movement. Rob Okun has been dedicating himself to that cause since the early 1980s. He was a founder of the Men's Resource Center for Change in Amherst, Massachusetts, and started that organization's magazine, Voicemail, in 1982. He now publishes it independently, and his new book, Voicemail, has brought together articles from that magazine to present a fascinating portrait of the development of the pro-feminist men's movement. I started out our conversation by asking Rob Okun to define pro-feminism.
Pro-feminism is really, from my perspective, it's men supporting the concept of feminism and all of that entails. I mean, I use the term pro-feminism as opposed to feminist man or male feminist because, as my colleague, the sociologist Michael Kimmel, has said, you know, feminist involves the empirical observation that women and men are not equal in either the private or the public sphere. And it also recognizes that while men may agree with that kind of an assessment of women's subordinate status, and men may want to work towards equality, men can believe in feminism, but to be a feminist requires another ingredient, the felt experience of oppression. And that's something that men can't feel because men aren't oppressed but are privileged by sexism. So being a pro-feminist is certainly keeping in the same spirit the values and the visions of feminists, but recognizing that as men, that term of declaring oneself a feminist is reserved, in my estimation, for women.
Now, you've been involved in the pro-feminist movement for a long time, at least since 1983, if not before. You were one of the founders of the Men's Resource Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. How did you find yourself as part of, and even in some ways a pioneer of this movement, at least the latter, this more modern phase of the pro-feminist movement? What in your own personal history brought you to this point?
The portal for me, the doorway that I came through most assertively was by becoming a father. And while it isn't essential for every man to be a father to recognize the value of embracing a pro-feminist position, I think in the 3 decades or so that I've been a dad that my responsibilities and my accessing the nurturing side of myself really awakened something that I think is in most men, is in all men when we're born, innately, you know, arriving on the planet with a clean slate. But I'm a writer and an editor, and I used to do a lot of radio commentaries. And when my children were small, I would write essays and do radio commentaries about the experience of being a dad. That was one strand that led me into this work. I think the other thing that happened for me was in the early 80s, I became aware of what was called feminist art, some of the work that Miriam Shapiro or Judy Chicago were doing. And I sort of was always interested in socially engaged art in general. And when I started to look at women's experiences in making art that addressed their circumstances, that kind of awakened another piece of the story. And then maybe the other component was a little bit of envy as I saw women in women's groups dropping in deep, having rich and meaningful conversations that explored their interior lives. I felt, as a lot of men did, a hunger for that, which initially might have been masked by some insecurity and confusion about where are all these women going off and having these gatherings together, and what about me, and, you know, doesn't one's partner have the capacity to be all things to all, you know, to their partner. So I think there was a lot of strands. I kind of told it in a inverse way, leading with the fatherhood piece, but I think that was the one that consistently allowed me to want to grow and explore my own interior life.
Now, you started Voicemail in 1983, part of the Men's Resource Center. Talk about the Men's Resource Center. I know it went through a couple of different names. It wasn't called that then. What was behind the founding of the center? What was its goal?
Yeah, it's a great story. The pro-feminist men's movement, which, you know, really started in the 70s, the late 70s, started having annual conferences. And the Men's Resource Center, which at the time, you're right, it did have another name, the Men's Resource Connection, a group of guys from Western Mass went to the conference. It was out in at Tufts, and they saw that there was this kind of a split between some of the people who were talking about social change issues and some of the people who were talking about personal growth issues. And rather than feeling that there was something contradictory about that, they came back and this was, you know, if this was the top of the first inning, I guess I showed up around the top of the second. And they came back and recognized that we don't have to feel some split, that we can be both and. So I always loved our tagline, which was supporting men and challenging men's violence, which at the face of it could seem contradictory. How can you both be supporting men and challenging men's violence when we saw them as both the, you know, the two wings of a dove? And so in those early days, there was as much interest in support groups, men socializing, hanging out, looking at some of the issues that were coming up in our personal lives. And this is the really important part that I think distinguishes the pro-feminist men's movement from some of the other groups that are part of, you know, their own definition of a men's movement. There was this deep recognition that there was an epidemic of violence being perpetrated against women out in the culture, and that maybe only a minority of men were perpetrating that violence, but for the majority of us to stand silently by was some form of colluding with that. And from the beginning, the efforts in building this Men's Resource Connection, as it was initially called, was really aimed towards addressing both issues, that we could look at our interior lives, but also had a responsibility to address the problems in the external world.
The Men's Resource Center, in fact, did run groups, am I right, ran groups for men who had been involved in domestic violence. Is that correct?
Yes. In any given week, the same group room where on a Sunday night was inhabited by a general drop-in men's support group, and on a Monday night for a gay and bisexual and questioning men's group, on a Tuesday and a Wednesday and a Thursday night was being inhabited by men who were acting abusively in their primary relationships. So we felt it was really important. It was in 1989. We were one of the first batterers intervention programs in the state of Massachusetts, and began running, I guess at its peak, there were a dozen groups running in the four counties of Western Mass that really began with this notion of what we termed compassionate confrontation. So the behavior, absolutely unacceptable, must change. The human being, we recognize that there are circumstances that led you to act this way. We're not going to cut you any slack because you are acting this way, but we're going to help you to build a bridge between what happened to you and why you made the choices that you made, and get to a place where you can honestly and with full accountability accept what you had done as someone who had abused his partner, his spouse, his wife, his girlfriend, or in some cases his children, and now are ready to go into the deep work of transformation. And we recognized how steep a hill that was to climb, because we were asking men in 20 or 30 or 40 weeks to repair 20 or 30 or 40 years of behavior.
Now, a lot of groups for men who have been perpetrators of domestic violence, you know, go on the anger management model, and my impression of them is that they are spectacularly ineffective. How effective was your group, and if so, how does it differ from the anger management model?
Anger management is, as it suggests, directing itself towards someone who needs some help in addressing issues of how they express anger. And often the people being referred to such groups or voluntarily, in quotes, joining such groups were dealing with issues in the workplace. Domestic violence and the act of battering is in a different category. There are judges who were not as discerning in those distinctions, and over the years have gotten much, much better. But a defense attorney representing someone who had the means to hire a defense attorney might make a case for, oh, Your Honor, a 10-week hour anger management group is what my client needs, and the other 40-week mandated group that costs so much more and is 2.5 hours long or 2 hours long, that's way over the top, and please show some mercy on my client. Well, if a judge got duped in that way, that person might get a little bit out of that group, but it wasn't going to get to the deeper issue of intimate partner violence. So a batterers intervention group that runs, the standards vary around the country, but I don't think there's any at this point that are less than 26 weeks, and many go 52 weeks. Some people stay in longer, and I think that the model is really looking at the whole range of behaviors, including some curriculum that addresses how you were socialized as a male to reach the kind of conclusions about your sense of privilege and your sense of entitlement that may have contributed to you feeling that you actually had a right to act abusively towards your partner. So there's a big distinction there. And I think that in a movement like the pro-feminist men's movement, incorporating work with men acting abusively and actually helping them to build a bridge between what they thought their role as a man in a family and in the culture was versus what's happening in actuality in the changing nature of families and in the society. And rather than feel threatened by women's ascendancy, they can actually feel there's plenty of room here for us to share things, and my own personal life is going to be enriched if I can, you know, get out of my own way.
I asked Rob Okun whether he felt that men who are abusers can really change their behavior.
The change is possible. It's some of the hardest work that I've ever seen men do. I ran these groups for several years as part of the Men's Resource Center at the same time that I was editing and working on Voicemail magazine. And often I would feel moved to write about what I had experienced as a group leader. But some of the men who came to an awareness of what they had done and recognized that they had it within themselves, if they were willing to stay in it for the long haul, could change, they could. And some of them have. And, you know, my friend and colleague, Sarah Elinoff Acker, just came out with a wonderful book called Unclenching Our Fists, Abusive Men on the Road to Nonviolence, which she recounts the stories of a dozen men who actually stayed in these groups for many, many, many years and consider themselves still in recovery, but are that little spark of possibility in a very difficult piece of work that a man has to do on his journey to heal and to transform himself.
In his book, Voicemail, Rob Okun makes a point pretty early on that notions of masculinity, while they confer privilege on men, also damage men. I asked him to talk about how those notions damage men.
Well, when, as men, we don't have as full a range of expression of our inner life, we suffer. We repress most of our feelings. We're not given a whole lot of permission to shed tears, you know, except if we, you know, win the game and, you know, or have some great emotional moment in the popular culture, and that our range of emotional expression ranges from anger to anger. So we're walking around with a lot of feelings that are bottled up inside. One of the exercises we used to do in the Batters Intervention Groups was talking about the emotional funnel, which if over the course of a day, small irritations that just get stuffed down and stuffed down and stuffed down, that they're just going to eventually, you know, have no place to go but come out. And while the majority of men are certainly not acting violently, a lot of men are not in touch with their feelings, and everybody knows some man who's best strategy for dealing with his inner life is to shut down, and he's moody, leave him alone, don't talk to him, he'll come out of it. But we're not really encouraging men to take on, doing therapy. I mean, all of these things are much better today than they were even 10, 15 years ago. But we live in a culture that starts from the earliest days telling little boys when they fall down and hurt themselves, the standard line, big boys don't cry. And that's where it begins. We hold back from finding our true selves, our full selves, expressing our full selves. And so that plays itself out in a lot of ways. The health issues are pretty stark. The high blood pressure and this other stress-related issues, our life expectancy compared to women, the amount of heart disease, all across the board, these are all aspects of, you know, toxic expression of masculinity that doesn't allow us to break out of, you know, what a lot of us in this work call the man box, that regimented space where acting like a cool, tough, strong, you know, stud is the message that we're given. And if we deviate from that, then we're going to get slammed outside. So that's how it plays out negatively in our health, in our both our physical health and our mental health.
In fact, your co-founder of the Men's Resource Center, Steve Botkin, talks about masculinity as a product, and he says it has a lot to do with disconnection. And then he says that violence and domination are a way to connect. I wonder if you could connect the dots between those two things, between disconnection and violence as a way to connect.
Well, it's been pretty demonstrated over and over that when we don't have any sense of belonging, when we are feeling that sense of isolation, and we want to have some kind of way to be in the world, that the default is to act out. I mean, it's a sad fact. I mean, we take it to the family member at the holidays who, never really learned how to get along with people and socialize, and suddenly there's that outburst at the family at the dinner table. Well, he's moody. He's shut down. But we take it to its extreme because we're not really interested in how we look at our sons. And of course, all of this is changing, and that's why the pro-feminist men's movement, in a book like Voicemail and the magazine that shares its name, is out there to offer some different ways of looking at these issues. Violence in the culture is really part of what men have been offered as our way to feel some sense of power. And it's a real negative power in this, because at heart, most of us want to do the right thing, but we're so stuck in old ideas of what it means to be a man that we're unable to fully reach in and touch the parts of ourselves that we didn't really know existed because we weren't given permission. So one of my colleagues, Alan Johnson, who wrote one of the most important books on the topic of patriarchy called The Gender Knot, but he wrote a piece that's in the book, Fatal Distraction, Manhood, Guns, and Violence, in which he looks at the issue of power and control, and that, guns and violence, he writes, are instruments of control, whether used by states or by individuals. They otherwise have no intrinsic value on their own. Their value comes from the simple fact that violence works as a means to intimidate, to dominate, and control. It works for governments and hunters. It works for police and batterers. It works for parents and schoolyard bullies, corporations, and, by extension, anyone who wants to feel larger and more powerful and in control than they otherwise would. So that's at base where a lot of men are coming from. They want to feel some sense of control, and they want to have that power. And for a lot of men today, with the world changing the way it is, it's a very confusing time. They think that women are somehow taking over when, of course, it's their inability to get in touch with that disconnect between their real lives and what's happening out in the world that's undermining their own ability to transform and to grow.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rob Okun about his book. He's the editor of the book Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. He was the editor since 1983 of the magazine Voicemail and a co-founder of the Men's Resource Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. You just spoke about power. One of the people in the book tackles the author Michael Gurian and his notions of biological determinism. He suggests that boys are doing worse than ever, doing worse than girls, thanks to feminism. That is what Gurian says. And that feminists have changed the rules. They've made boys the problem. Boys will be boys. It's all about testosterone. And I don't remember the name of the person who is critiquing him in this, but he says testosterone is not the problem.
It's unfortunate that some good intended writers and therapists and people involved in aspects of men's work are taking a jaundiced look at feminism and feeling that that's somehow demonizing boys. I think the piece that you're referring to was by the sociologist Michael Kimmel, who has written and edited a number of books on men and masculinity, and did this piece that looked at a variety of the books that had come out. And I think that saying that, oh, somehow because we've put attention on improving circumstances for girls and women, that somehow boys are getting the short end of the stick. What we finally recognize is that we haven't been looking at boys in a way that has been helpful to them. The ways that we've been raising boys and educating boys hasn't been allowing us to find that fuller expression of our humanity. So at a time when a lot of attention and funding went towards improving circumstances for girls, it wasn't that we took away from boys. It's that we were recognizing that we hadn't been offering girls enough. And once we started to do that, it allowed some space for critiques to come up to say, well, what about the boys? And now we're at a place where young men are getting more attention, not just in the academic sphere, but I think as importantly in our extracurricular activities. And all of this for me comes down to, are we helping boys at a really young age to connect with their hearts? Are we encouraging them to developing their nurturing side, their capacity to be compassionate? Those are the kinds of aspects of their emotional intelligence that have been underappreciated, undervalued, and underexplored. And I think that more than anything else, if we put our attention there, is going to both improve boys' lives, and of course, if they are more in touch with themselves and if their emotional intelligence is cultivated, then everyone in their lives, regardless of gender, is going to benefit from being connected to them.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you're right, it was Michael Kimmel. He makes the real link to privilege, though. I mean, I think this is kind of the issue here, or the difficult issue here, which is that at the same time that boys could gain so much from pro-feminism, men and boys would be giving something up, and that is privilege.
Well, it depends on how you interpret that word. It's true that, I'm paraphrasing Frederick Douglass, but power gives up nothing without a fight. And for those of us who just arrived, we didn't have anything to do with it. We just arrived in these male-identified bodies, that somehow that we have special entitlement, special privilege, it's unfair. So if your bottom line for how you want to operate both as a individual or in a community or in a society is fairness, then you're going to say, I've had a good ride as a male with a lot of privileges and entitlements, and I certainly don't want to see my daughter or my sister get the short end of the stick, so I'm going to be willing to shift. I'm going to be willing to change. And the problem for a lot of men is when they first confront the fact that they do have privilege and they do have entitlement, is if I lose that, what am I gaining? And they don't have an answer to that. And I think the answer that the book, if taken as a whole, and the movement as taken as a whole, offers as an answer is that you have your own full expression of your humanity. You have your full life to live. Maybe you're going to be healthier. Maybe you're going to be less stressed out. Maybe you're going to be more connected to your spouse and your children. Maybe, God forbid, or goddess forbid, maybe you're going to be happier.
Rob Okun. We'll talk more about pro-feminism and the book he edited, a collection of essays from the journal Voicemail, after a short break. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rob Okun about the men's movement to support gender equality and end male violence towards women. It's called pro-feminism, and Okun has brought together a collection of articles that tell the previously untold story of that movement. The articles are taken from the magazine Okun has published since 1982, Voicemail, that's M-A-L-E, and that's the title of his book. You say in the book that you are very hopeful. You're a kind of half-glass-full guy. But as I look around the gender landscape, I see more the glass half-empty. I mean, I see an incredible growth of anti-women politics on the national scale, a sports culture that really denigrates women, boys who seem to be growing up with ideas that women are just to be exploited sexually. It seems in many ways worse than what I knew in the 1980s, you know, after 10 years of the women's movement that began in the 70s. I wonder if you could talk about kind of the forces of reaction and why you're still so hopeful.
You know, we're in a situation now where there's only one direction to go, and that's, you know, towards a more gender-just world. And we are going to be experiencing some of the short-term setbacks. It's no question that it's unconscionable and unnerving and unbelievable that we're having to work so hard to protect and make sure that women's reproductive rights are maintained and increased at a time when we thought those struggles had been waged and won decades ago. And there's no question that we are at a time where there is a more overt expression of sexual violence and sexual assault. But part of that is when problems that have been occluded from a lot of us for a long time are suddenly exposed, that in that period of opening the wound before the healing can happen and the full recuperation can happen, we have to go through some of the pain. So in the case of violence against women, you know, it was 20 years ago that the then senator from Delaware, Joe Biden, was a key figure in shepherding the Violence Against Women Act through Congress, and it made incredible difference to women's lives. And we found in the last year or two, until it finally passed, that there was tremendous resistance to reauthorizing it because it was recognizing other kinds of violence against lesbians and Native Americans, and the forces of reaction were wanting to keep it really simple. We only want to be helping these women. We don't want to be helping all the women. And we're at a time where, because men, some feeling threatened, are speaking out, holding on to the end of their privilege, that we are finding ourselves having to revisit some of the struggles and the battles that we thought we'd won. But if one looks at the first chapter of the book, which really looks at this untold story of the pro-feminist men's movement, that first chapter profiles about 20 organizations that are currently active taking on all of these issues. And they're national, and they're regional, and they're wide-ranging in what they're doing. But one of my colleagues who we just talked about, my friend Michael Kimmel, his latest book is called Angry White Men. And the subtitle is really kind of interesting because it's American Masculinity at the End of an Era. And I think that's the key here. When you're maybe feeling, and maybe some of the your friends and other women that you know may be feeling a little bit despairing about how the gender justice landscape looks today, I think that's important to be remembering, that this is American Masculinity at the End of an Era, and maybe in a way Voicemail, the untold story of the pro-feminist men's movement, is the beginning of that new era where the most important thing that we as men can do is to speak out. Too many of us take the role of bystander and have allowed those minority of voices, whether it's the sexual assaulters in the military or the minority of priests who've abused boys and girls in the church, or the men's rights activists who seek to define masculinity in that old stereotyped Marlboro man way. For us to sit back and be quiet is a form of collusion. And I think that for men today, there's probably more men who would be defined as pro-feminist. There are probably millions of us, and they just don't know it. Because when you ask a man, just as if you ask a 18-year-old college first-year female who might say, oh, feminism, that's not a word that I embrace. I don't describe that. And then you ask her about all of these privileges and rights that her mom has talked to her about, and she said, of course I believe in all of those. Well, that's the definition of feminism, of just fairness, and I want to be able to have the same job, and I want to have the same opportunities. Well, you ask men that, and they're going to say the same thing now. So we're really at the beginning of this new era, and I think that whether or not one uses the word pro-feminist or anti-sexist or just, I just want to do the right thing, I'm not as interested in the terminology as I am in advancing this transformation of men and masculinity.
I am heartened by what you say. I just have one final question, which is, do women have a role in men's healing from sexism and masculinity?
Of course. My experience is, and I don't know if I coined this term, but it's one I've been using a long time, is that most of us as men were pretty lacking in an ability to speak emotionalese, a language that women are fluent in, and that we stumble around trying to just have the most basic terms. So because of the ways, this is, you know, we need a whole other show to talk about women's socialization, but I think that the upside of growing up female, one of them, is that emotional ease of being able to get in and explore the inner life. So women have a lot to offer men in finding our hearts and exploring how we connect our heads and our hearts and advance the best of what we can be as people.
It's a wonderful book, and this has been a wonderful conversation, Rob Okun. I've known of your work for many years. Your work in the Men's Resource Center in Amherst and the pro-feminist movement, and now in editing this book, Voicemail. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Francesca.
Rob Okun. His book, Voicemail, is out from Interlink Books. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with poet Honor Moore about poems from the women's movement. Stay tuned.
The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do because the woman in your life is in.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before the modern women's movement was born in the 1970s, the idea of women's solidarity was foreign to our culture. Women were supposed to compete for a man, not join together to explore and enrich their own lives. Poet and writer Honor Moore was there at the beginning of that movement. She points out in her wonderful introduction to the collection she edited, Poems from the Women's Movement, that poetry was vital to the movement, giving eloquent voice to lives that had been until then unspoken. I spoke to Honor Moore in 2009 and started out by asking her why, as one of the poets in the book says, poetry was the women's movement.
Women were, in any way possible, either through consciousness-raising groups, through violently polemical essays, and through poems, seeking to have access to a part of themselves which had been suppressed in the 1950s, 1960s, post-war American society. So that a friend was reminding me yesterday, it was a time when a New York Times want ad would say, "Help wanted, men only."
Wow.
So that if you wanted to be something other than a secretary or a nurse's aide or a nurse, you couldn't apply for the job. Think about it. No women's centers, no battered women's shelters. It was a time when you could read every book that a woman had written. So you started to have a little shelf on which there were books by women. No women doctors, no women lawyers, no women Supreme Court justices. And on and on it goes. I think that maybe even we forget that, women of our generation, but certainly young women who, although there's still work to be done, young women, you know, they can go to medical school. There's no quota on how many women a medical school accepts. There was a definite tracking system into gender roles, and that experience was deeply internalized, and so it made sense that an art form like poetry, which speaks, as it were, from the soul, would begin speaking as a woman.
You mentioned that your great life-changing event was a poetry reading at NYU. Could you describe the scene for us? You talk about that in the book. Put us there.
Well, it's a room in the lately lamented Loeb Student Center, now torn down and replaced by something huger. You know, a kind of one of those college university gathering rooms, sort of linoleum tile on the floor, fluorescent light. And the entire room was packed with women. They were all wearing blue jeans and combat boots and sandals and dressed like we were in our rebellious way. Of course, some had heavy eye makeup and black turtlenecks. You know, it was a kind of spectrum of dress. And there weren't enough chairs for everybody. I remember sitting on the floor, and one after another, a woman would get up to the front, and she would say, you know, my name is so-and-so, and I'm going to read this poem. And she would read a poem about having been a prostitute, or a poem about having had an abortion, or a poem about her husband having left her flat, or she might be Rita Mae Brown, in which case she'd read this poem, which I just adore. "My voice rings down through thousands of years to coil around your body and give you strength. You who have wept in direct sunlight, who have hungered in invisible chains, tremble to the cadence of my legacy. An army of lovers shall not fail." Okay, she would read that, and everybody would hoop and scream and holler and carry on. I mean, these were revolutionary words at the time. And each poem would sort of demonstrate a revelation. And these readings would take place all over the country. For instance, there was a whole movement of women poets happening at the same time in California. And one of the leaders of that movement was a poet named Alta. She ran a press called Shameless Hussy Press. And here's her short poem, "Miscarriage." "Let's try again. Lots more where that came from. Ha ha. Don't say lost the baby. Sounds like you misplaced it. Let's see. I had it here a couple of days ago." And these poems were shocking. You know, the way of looking at the world was shocking at the time. And so one left such events feeling that you were not alone. And then we started having these group readings all the time. So you'd have to write another poem so that you'd have another poem to read at the next reading. And that's how we began to write poems, women, as I say. And one of the poems that I wrote for one of those events was called Polemic Number One, which starts, "This is the poem to say write poems, women, because I want to read them, because for too long we have had mostly men's lives or men's imaginations wandering through our lives, because even the women's lives we have details of come through a male approval desire filter, which diffuses imagination, that most free part of ourselves." The poem goes on, And actually, I realized while writing it that male approval desire spells M-A-D, mad. So later in the poem I say, I have driven many women mad. You know, the women's movement is said to have been humorless. Au contraire, we really had a lot of humor with our rage. But of course, there were then darker and more painful poems.
We're talking with poet Honor Moore about poems from the women's movement. She edited the anthology. It spans works from 1965 to 1982, including those of Sylvia Plath, Marge Piercy, Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, and many others. You say in your introduction, and you really hear it here, that the inner lives of women came into language.
That's right.
You actually start with Sylvia Plath.
Yes.
Tell us why.
I start with Sylvia Plath because I really mark the beginning of this movement of women poets with the publication in the United States in 1966 of Sylvia Plath's Ariel. At that time, she had been dead 2 or 3 years, so one had heard about this woman poet who had committed suicide, and now these poems were widely available in this book called Ariel, and it was like a shock. The poet Jean Valentine, who has a poem in the book, actually said, reminiscing about those years, that she had a manuscript ready for publication when she read those poems from Ariel, and she just sat down and rewrote it. She felt that
wow.
She was given permission to be much more overt and much more open with her experience as a woman. And I don't mean merely from the point of view of confession, but I mean making use of elements of female experience as metaphor.
So you're really saying that in giving language to women's interior lives, that this is the voice that had been silenced for centuries, really?
For centuries. Now, in fact, once we began to write our poems, we could look back at poets whom we perhaps had read in college and see that their most powerful and overtly female work had been suppressed. For instance, you would have a poet like H.D. who wrote these sort of marvelous, epic, modernist poems like Trilogy and Helen in Egypt, which to my mind are on a par with Pound's Cantos and Eliot's The Wasteland in terms of their ambition and in terms of the way they conceive of what a poem can do. But the poems of H.D.'s that one read were short little imagistic poems. So there were women writing strong poems, but as the canon began to be formed and women were given their one or two slots, often the poems that were chosen were not the poems to which a woman of my generation starting to write poems could, out of that kind of new feminist rage, could relate. The other thing was that many women poets were stuck in a kind of honesty out of a situation of oppression. That is to say, Plath and Sexton, you know, were writing protest poems out of their condition as women. And what happened in the moment I celebrate and mark in this anthology, it was a kind of explosion that cleared the way for women to write more deeply and ambitiously, to take on more of the world. Also allowed, I think, and given permission for, in this moment, were great bodies of work by Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, Muriel Rukeyser, June Jordan.
What you're really talking about here is the great innovation that the women's movement brought to society, and that is the idea that the personal is political.
Yes, which has become trivialized in subsequent decades, but which at the time, and what that means is that each of us walks around in the world with an individual social identity, social/political identity, and that my identity as a woman, as a white privileged woman, is different from somebody else's identity as an African-American working class man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that our lives carry with them a politics. And that was really something that the women's movement invented.
Also, you mentioned Adrienne Rich, who I think was my first favorite poet as a teenager and a young woman. And she talks about the tradition of connectedness, which is another whole theme of the women's movement. You know, we had been raised to see other women as rivals.
Yes, as rivals and competitors and certainly not the other people in a community of which we might feel lucky to be a part. And that really was her among many great connections, that the third poem of hers that I include, Fantasia for Elvira Shatayev, I remember the first time I heard that poem was when she read it, and Elvira Shatayev was the leader of a women's climbing team, all of whom died in a storm on Lenin Peak in the USSR in August 1974, and the husband finds and buries the bodies. And it's a poem about this community of women, or rather it is about this community of women who climbed this mountain together, but also they become a kind of emblem of the women's movement. She's writing in the voice of Elvira Shatayev. Now I am further ahead than either of us dreamed. She's talking to her husband. Anyone would be. I have become the white snow packed like asphalt by the wind, the women I love lightly flung against the mountain, that blue sky, our frozen eyes unribboned through the storm. We could have stitched that blueness together like a quilt. And then she refers to the women as a cable of blue fire. A cable of blue fire ropes our bodies burning together in the snow. We will not live to settle for less. We have dreamed of this all our lives. And it's a kind of moment when she's writing at the height of her powers, and the metaphor of that, the sense of what we're all part of, comes together in that very strong metaphor. I later taught a class in the history of women poets, and I called it A Cable of Blue Fire, that idea that I was talking about before, that we found our sisterhood in the poets who had gone before when we began to really scrutinize the work of theirs that had been suppressed or misread.
She has another poem that you have in the book, Honor Moore, and the book is Poems from the Women's Movement, Planetarium. Uh-huh. And I love the way it begins with a woman in the shape of a monster in the shape of a woman. The skies are full of them, you know, referring to the way in which women have been mythologized in the naming of the constellations.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk about the role of myth in the women's movement.
A lot of women poets went back to Greek and Roman mythology to find and reread certain the lives of certain women. One in particular that I'm thinking of in this book is Louise Glück's poem Pomegranate, which is about Persephone, and Alice Notley's wonderful short poem called The Goddess Who Created This Passing World. There were many goddess poems. I was thrilled to find this one. I'll read it because it's short and glorious. The goddess who created this passing world, the goddess who created this passing world said, let there be light bulbs and liquefaction. Life spilled out onto the street, colors whirled, cars and the variously shod feet were born in the past and future, and I born too. Light as air mail paper, away she flew to Annapurna or Mount McKinley or both, but instantly clarified, composed, forever was I meant by her to recognize a painting as beautiful or a movie stunning, and to adore the finitude of words, and to understand as surfaces my dreams, know the eye, the organ of affection, and depths to be inflections of her voice and wrist and smile. A wonderful poem about the integration of the goddess into our consciousness. And I think what happened was that, you know, women poets just went nuts with all these great women in myth. I end the book with Eileen Miles' wonderful poem about Joan of Arc, in which she sort of takes this forceful Joan, and, you know, usually Joan dies at the end. But in this poem we have, she was 19 years old when they burned her body in the middle of town while she was still alive. A white dove came out of her mouth as she died. 431 years ago today, a dove leaped right out of her mouth. And I love that idea that a dove, which is a kind of image of peace and also transformation, and also poetry, you know, sort of the idea of poetry being something which speaks what cannot be spoken, emerging as a dove. And in a way, I see the book as, you know, it begins with "Are you our sort of person?" and it ends with "A dove leaped right out of her mouth." And that's quite a distance to go in a little more than a decade.
Yes, and that is a beautiful poem. And you're really talking about the whole way in which women reclaimed and redefined mythology, because, of course, women in myth had often so for so many centuries been defined by men.
Yeah.
And there's another poem, I think, that really speaks right to that, to kind of the demystification of women, saying, hey, we're real. And that's Katha Pollitt's poem, Metaphors of Women.
Yeah. Yeah, she said, what if the moon was never a beautiful woman? Call it a shark shearing across black water, an ear, a drum in the desert, a window, a bone shoe. What if the sea was discovered to have no womb? Let it be clouds, blue as the day they were born, a ceremony of bells and questions, a toothache, a lost twin. What if a woman is not the moon or the sea? Say map of the air, say green parabola, lichen and the stone that feeds it. No rain, rain.
Honor Moore, while the women's movement certainly had its share of internal conflict, often centering around issues of race and class, you point to the solidarity in the movement that also flourished.
One of the reasons I love the photograph on the cover of this book is that it does really note the diversity of the women's movement as I remember it at the beginning. And I think that it's one of the truths of the women's movement that it was racially diverse from the very beginning.
With poets like Audre Lorde and others as well. I mean, great, great poets.
Yes. And but also activists. Not that we didn't work on racism, you know, but it was something that was worked on from the very beginning.
Poet Honor Moore, and the book is Poems from the Women's Movement. It's a collection of poems from 1965 to 1982. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.